Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 424th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of program and practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also a professor at the University of Alberta. And with us today, again, is Dr. Sam Moe, who is a member of our team in the peer group and here at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. Sam?
Hi, everybody. I'm Samantha Moe. I'm a clinical pharmacist by training, and now I'm working with the College of Family Physicians of Canada, helping them develop educational content and tools.
And basically keeping me alive.
Exactly. And doing all his work. And if you remember the last podcast, what we were trying to do is we were taking some, you know, hopefully very primary care useful questions and answering them. And we're going to continue on with that process. We're going to do about five of them, I hope, by the end of this podcast. So I think there'll be a little bit in it for everybody. So where are we going to start, Sam?
Right.
So our first question today is, does targeting lower blood pressure in older adults have more benefits than harms? And so the background to this is most of you will recall the SPRINT trial, because I know you've talked about it on the podcast. But for those of you who need a bit of a refresher, the SPRINT is a randomized controlled trial that was published back in 2015. And it was comparing intensive blood pressure lowering versus standard blood pressure lowering among patients with a higher cardiovascular risk. And so they wanted to compare a systolic blood pressure of less than 120 versus less than 140. To get into the SPRINT trial, they had various different criteria. High risk could have been you had a previous event or you had a certain Framingham score, or you could also be elderly over the age of 75. And so today, the article that we're going to talk about is specifically around the subgroup of older patients over the age of 75 who were studied in SPRINT. So in this particular subgroup, there were 2,600 patients. Their mean age was 80. About 38% of them were female. Their baseline blood pressure was 142 over 71. Their Framingham risk was on average 25%, so they were high risk. And about 30% of them were frail. So in the study, these patients achieved a systolic blood pressure of 123 versus 135 millimeter mercury, so about 11 millimeter mercury difference. And their primary outcome was a composite of many different cardiovascular events. And that composite turned out to be statistically improved in the intensive lowering group. So a hazard ratio of 0.66, or a number needed to treat of 27. All-cause mortality was also significantly reduced in the intensive group. So a hazard ratio of 0.67 with a number needed to treat of 41. They also looked at harms. And I guess the important thing to talk about with harms is that in the original SPRINT trial, a lot of these harms turned out to be statistically different. And what you'll see as we talk about them is that in this particular subgroup, several of them were not statistically different. But keep in mind that we're dealing with like a lower or subgroup of that population, so we have less statistical power to be able to show differences. Serious adverse effects were no different, so 48% in each group. There was a trend towards an increase in hypotension, syncope, and acute kidney injury.
I was just going to interrupt because, as you know, Sam, if you listen to our part, we don't like the word trend, but I know exactly.
Okay.
Well, no, which is totally fine, because but that's how you'll see things reported and so on. And I think, and by trend, what you meant, and often mm-hmm. what people mean is it was approaching statistical significance for some of these, and. I think your comments were very valid, is that I think all of these adverse events were statistically greater when you looked at the SPRINT trial yes. overall, like the hypotension and the kidney injury and so on. And Mike, you might want to correct me if I'm wrong, or Sam, is that the balance of those was relatively similar to the actual benefit that was seen. It was, with kidney injury and so on and with that. And so, it wouldn't surprise me if that these... adverse effects, or depend on whether you're talking about adverse effects or adverse events, are probably real, but it's really tricky to know what to do.
Yeah, we maybe roll our eyes at the whole idea of trend. I might roll my eyes a bit at the idea of statistical significance. Like that, doesn't matter so much to me. That this hypotension, the hazard ratio was 1.7, and the odds ratio, the confidence intervals were 0.97 to 3.09. To me, that says something almost certainly is happening there.
Yeah.
And the fact that it did when we had bigger power, all of that, this, to me, we found the same results, really, that hypotension occurs. And I don't really care whether it's statistically significant or not. The effect is there. To me, this is a concern. I don't think it was quite as, I don't think the harms were quite as high as the benefits, but they were still there, and it requires a lot of nuance, which we'll get into as Sam goes on.
Go ahead, Sam.
I was going to say, even though like not statistically different, still important to monitor, I think, even if you're trying to incorporate this in practice.
Yeah, sure. And Mike, I agree with you. The word trend is equally annoying to the arbitrary thresholds for statistically significant. It's just sort of the wording that we used about it. So keep going, Sam. Good.
Mm-hmm. So for patients who had no underlying kidney disease at the beginning of the trial, they saw an increased risk of kidney injury. So that was defined as a decrease in GFR by at least 30% to a target of less than 60 mils per minute, or dialysis or transplantation. So there was a harm even if you did not have underlying kidney disease. As well, injurious falls and orthostatic hypotension, again, no difference between groups, but I would argue it's definitely worth monitoring for if you're thinking about implementing this. In terms of how this study fits into the context of other studies, so certainly we talked about evidence supporting a blood pressure of less than 140 over 90 for the general population, including those who are diabetic and who have renal disease. And I think that the results of SPRINT can be applied to patients over the age of 75, but there's an important caveat to say that this trial excludes many different patients, and we'll just list them here for you. So it excluded diabetic patients, patients who had had a history of stroke, heart failure patients with an ejection fraction of less than 35% or who were symptomatic, patients who have a GFR less than 20 mils per minute, if patient's blood pressure was less than 110 after 1 minute of standing, patients who have dementia or nursing home residents, all these patients were excluded. So there's a large subset who were not included in this trial and are important to keep in mind as you're thinking of applying it. So the bottom line is, were you going to say something, James?
No. Go. I was going to say, because this is always very tricky, because in theory there is a benefit, but I think, you know, especially in studies like the SPRINT, where they're going to be much more coddled, if you will, than just the general population. Mm-hmm. We do need to worry about the adverse events. There appears to be some benefit from this one study. I mean, other ones have not shown as much benefit, but the most important thing is to do no harm. So it's all about, you know, slow reduction in blood pressure, and also not to get people too upset about it, because nowhere in the SPRINT discussion was the fact that you make a lot more people by definition ill by saying your blood pressure is too high. So none of those things come into the process, but they come into every thought process that you see with patients. I think you'd probably agree, eh, Mike?
Yeah, and there are many caveats to this. The exclusion of diabetics, I think, is important, because they were the ones that it seems harder to show this lower BP is beneficial, even though in the Canadian guidelines it's argued for a 130 target, even though we don't have research yet supporting that. The other thing is that these were all done on automated cuffs. So if you were doing manual BPs, which we know read at least five points or so higher, you would need to adjust your target somewhat, because even if you were trying to follow SPRINT, because when they were getting near 120 BPs, they were on automated cuffs, which on a manual would probably be around 125 to 130. So it's there is nuance to all of this that we need to consider, and very much the range of patients that are in front of you, because we have. I've tried to get to a lower BP in patients and haven't been as successful as they were in this trial without significant kind of symptomatic hypotension and just feeling unwell.
And more pills and more cost and all that sort of stuff. So,
I'm not saying it's not a reasonable idea. I'm just saying it might be harder to actualize in practice than than it is on this simple paper. I mean, that's obvious. We know, like, we've been obvious the last few times, but this is actually, it's not that the trial's wrong by any stretch. It's just, it requires a lot of nuance in its interpretation.
Mm-hmm. So over the 3 years, the bottom line is an intense blood pressure target led to a reduction in cardiovascular events and all-cause mortality in older adults compared to a standard target. But if you are going to consider it, make sure your patient doesn't have any exclusions, advise the patient of the harm and benefit, and check their standing blood pressure before they start therapy, and please monitor their electrolytes, creatinine, and vitals.
Great. Okay, what's the next one, Mike?
One that you'll, I think you'll enjoy, James, and which is a really good one for me too, because I've struggled with this in practice, and that is, does a negative urine culture mean there's no infection? And this goes beyond the actual question to me, which is, does a how helpful is a urine dip? Mm-hmm. All of these kind of things. I personally have come to the conclusion that if a patient tells me a good story and they have a history, I'm done. But let's get into what the data says.
And by done, you mean you're comfortable with the diagnosis. you're not saying just get out of my office.
I leave.
Yeah, I just leave.
Just,
I'm sorry.
Poor patient sitting there. See ya. Time for me to go home. This is from an observational survey. So they looked at 220 women with urinary tract symptoms. And that included dysuria, increased frequency, or a sense of urgency. And they also included 86 women without any UTI symptoms. And then they did bacterial culture plus quantitative PCR. So why does that matter? Well, PCR is picks up bacteria a little bit better. And so the theory is maybe it is a more reliable test for urinary tract infections. So what they found is in women who had UTI symptoms, 81% of them were positive on urine culture, and 96 were positive on the PCR test, the quantitative PCR. When they looked at women without symptoms, 11% were positive on culture, which is not unpredictable, and 12% were positive on PCR. So much more close agreement on those without symptoms as being truly negative, with only about 1 in 10 being having some bacteria around, versus in the UTI symptoms, you can see that there's about a 15% increase in PCR saying there is an infection there versus urine culture. So urine culture was helpful for about 4 out of 5 patients, but not helpful for another 15% or so, close to another quarter, one-fifth. So the majority of cases, of course, were E. coli. That should come as no surprise to any of us. There are other research that have looked at this kind of thing. There was a UTI where they took patients with symptoms but a negative dipstick and gave them 3 days of trimethoprim and found that that reduced symptoms better than not treating them. So what that meant is the negative dipstick was not reliable. And then they looked at cost-effectiveness study comparing immediate antibiotics to delayed antibiotics to targeted antibiotics based on dipstick, et cetera. And they found that there was really no difference between the three approaches, so or not a meaningful difference. So really going ahead and just treating people is a reasonable approach. Now, we don't use PCR in practice, so don't think of ordering that to find out if someone has a urinary tract infections. These were uncomplicated UTIs, so it's not people who you think might be developing pylo, have fever, have other things like being elderly, catheterized, all sorts of things like that, being recently pregnant. And we're not sure about how it applies to non-E. coli, but the majority are E. coli anyway. So the bottom line here is that a negative culture does not necessarily mean no infection. And I think you already knew this, James, but it is an interesting reminder to this complex problem, to something that we think is so simple and easy. And symptoms are a very strong indicator of disease, and women can be treated rather than waiting for a culture.
Oh, no, for sure. And we've talked about this before, and this type of approach is being sort of recommended for probably years and years and years. And I think, you know, even to the point where, you know, if you have what you believe is a competent patient who can appreciate when or when they don't have symptoms, there's no reason, in my opinion, not to just give them, you know, a number of days worth, or I sometimes say the word vat of antibiotics, so that they can so that they can treat themselves. Because, you know, I'm sure you know, Mike, that, you know, it's not uncommon that women will have urinary tract infections a couple times a year, and other than, you know, you are a charming man, there's no reason to come in and see you if they're reliable and they're going to take 3 days and they're fully aware that, you know, these are the symptoms that I do need to see you. If, you know, if you got a fever, you know, back pain, or you just feel absolutely rotten, then you probably should be coming in and seeing someone. But these can be self-treated, and there have been studies that have looked at doing that, and this almost proves that you don't need to have that culture in many cases.
Yeah, exactly. And so someone who's having recurrent episodes that aren't resolving well, so you treat with a course of something and 3 days later they're sick again, et cetera, that's a different matter.
Totally.
But for the vast majority of cases, I agree. Women who have recurrence, one of the things I offer them is, you know, the 3-day course that they can either take. You can give them a number of days more than they have. So, like, let's say 9 days of Cipro or Ceftriaxone, and then you say, just take 3 days worth at a time for each interval, and then you have a bunch at home. Or you can give them scripts that they just refill, so they don't have to come in at all and see you or have them at home. But even patients who come in now, I don't generally chase a lot of the testing. And when it's negative, but their story is really, really good, I recommend treatment. It's interesting. Some patients will kind of get hung up on the fact that if they've already had the urine dip before they see me, what were the results? And I'll say, and then they'll say, oh, so I don't have it. I'll have to say, actually, we don't know. We don't know if it's positive if you do have it, and we don't know if it's negative that you don't have it.
Yeah.
So it's not a helpful test, particularly given the power of the story in this case. The history is so much more reliable than the testing. It's a fascinating thing that we depend on testing when history is better than the tests.
Yeah, God forbid you ask people about symptoms.
Yeah, so I'm much more likely, and I think these short courses are an excellent option now for us. We've got 3 days of treatment, and you can resolve things.
And I don't think it needs to be said, but repeat post treatment cultures are completely useless.
Maybe someone still does them.
No, no, I was just going to say, I agree. I think most people aren't doing it, but it feels sometimes right. Well, I need to check to make sure it's gone. Well, no, if you don't have symptoms, it's probably gone.
For urine cultures, you need to follow up. Okay, Sam, you are going to regale us with stories about melatonin for the treatment of migraines.
So we're changing gears. So we're going to talk about the use of melatonin for the prevention of migraines, actually. So this was a double-blind randomized trial of 178 patients, and they had to have a history of 1 year of migraine, 1 year history of migraine to get into this trial. And what they did is they wanted to know whether melatonin was effective for the prevention of migraines. So melatonin 3 milligrams a day, and they compared it to amitriptyline 25 milligrams versus placebo, and they did so for 12 weeks. About 3/4 of the patients here were women, and on average they were 37 years old. So what they found was that melatonin and amitriptyline were better than placebo in several parameters. So fewer migraine days per month, reduced headache intensity, a decreased analgesic use, and mean attack duration was also decreased. So when we talk about attack duration, they found that the duration was reduced by 4 to 5 hours, which is pretty clinically important. In terms of headache intensity, they found that there was a 1.3 difference on a 10-point scale. So maybe that one not so clinically important, but they did show consistency across several outcomes versus placebo. Interestingly, when they did a responder analysis, so they wanted to know how many patients had a 50% improvement in headache frequency compared with melatonin, what they found was that melatonin had more responders than amitriptyline, so 54% versus 39%, absolute difference of 15% with a number needed to treat of 6 over 12 weeks. So it's kind of interesting, like on all the other parameters, amitriptyline and melatonin were similar, but on this one responder analysis, melatonin was looking a bit better than amitriptyline. So when we went back to look to see what other data was out there, we did find a systematic review of melatonin, which included 7 studies, but it was a mixed design. So they had some randomized trials and they also had observational data. And when you look through the placebo-controlled trials, they showed conflicting results. So sometimes the study showed placebo was better and sometimes they showed melatonin was better. And when you looked at the trials where they compared melatonin versus active drug, also conflicting results. So we pulled one study that looked at amitriptyline versus melatonin. And in the study in pediatrics, amitriptyline was superior to melatonin for several outcomes, including like frequency, severity, duration, and so forth. So interestingly, effectiveness of melatonin versus placebo is inconsistent, I would say, right now. And its effectiveness versus amitriptyline is also inconsistent. So I think while it might be reasonable to try melatonin for migraine prevention, I would probably argue that amitriptyline has more consistently shown to be better than placebo, with a number needed to treat of 8 for headache, severity, and frequency. And I think I would probably start there first and wait to see for some more data to come out versus placebo.
But it's not natural.
Yeah, no, it's not.
Yeah. And so, you know, it certainly, there are many, many options and actually many different treatments that have been shown to be effective above placebo. Absolutely. For this, you know, you got beta blockers and there's many other one-off studies that have looked at this. So it's just nice that melatonin has another potential option because this is not news to anyone, but amitriptyline can cause some side effects and people may not want to take an antidepressant for that sort of thing. So it certainly seems to be something that could be reasonably tried, but we also have, you know, I'd say at least 10 or 15 other products that have been shown to reduce, you know, the frequency and severity and so on. And typically the numbers, Mike, and maybe Sam, you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, where we see if you give placebo, you get about, and when it comes to a responder analysis, about 25% of people will get a greater than 50% improvement in headache frequency if you give placebo, about 25%. And then when you give something like amitriptyline, maybe melatonin, you go from about 25% up to about 45 or 50%, realizing it doesn't help everybody. But those are the sort of numbers I remember. And there was it's consistently inconsistent that any one drug is better than another. However, it is consistent that not everyone responds to every drug, and so you need to sort of try it. And most of what's really important, and I know it took us 23 minutes, but I think you should use low doses, Mike.
Oh,
bing! Yeah, there we go.
Yes, it's not a bad idea by any stretch, but there are, as you mentioned, there are a ton of studies, and some of the studies on migraines are single trials of single drugs like verapamil and some of the ACE inhibitors have been tried and all sorts of things. But I think your go-to, and this is supported by the some of the guidelines right now, is the TCAs, particularly amitriptyline and the beta blockers. Mm-hmm. Those are the two that I think have the greatest body of evidence. But there are tons of options. And so patients with recurrent migraine should explore those options.
And one thing I would suggest is if you use those agents and you get a response, I really would encourage people. Now, if you perfectly tolerate them, which is really relatively unusual. I mean, people, you know, don't go, oh, I feel so much better on a beta blocker. I mean, there are circumstances that you are for some sort of conditions that you can be treating. You know, find the lowest dose. Say, look, it's brilliant that it's worked. We tried just this one dose. Why don't we try to find the lowest dose or have the patient try it and let them do that. So, yeah, no.
This I is try to find the highest dose.
Oh, I know.
I that try way to find the highest dose.
Yeah, that way they won't come back to you. Okay.
Okay, the next one is there a correlation with the mini mental status exam and driving risk with dementia? So mini mental status exam is relevant here because obviously it's the one that was probably the most taught around the assessment of dementia. And one of the things that is the bane of, I think, many family doctors' existence and primary care providers is the assessment of driving risk. And it is challenging, to say the least, around patients with deteriorating memory and cognitive function, where you have to, you know, it's normal in medicine to break bad news, but for some reason, the discussion around driving and the ability to drive is an area that I have seen in my practice and heard from many colleagues is an area that can drive a wedge in the relationship between us. So it's a
you're taking away independence.
Yeah, you absolutely are. You absolutely are, and it's a huge deal, often for more than one person. So if one person is the primary driver or the only driver, you're basically homebounding. In the mind of the patients at the immediate time, you're basically binding them to their home for eternity, which is a terrible thing to think about. Now, there are options for them, etc., but it's still not as much flexibility, as much fun as just driving yourself. So let's move on and talk about, this is a guidance document with a review element to it. And what they ended up recommending is obviously some of the things that we would do anyway, and that is consulting with family members about driving safety. So how's your father been in a driving accident? Have they come close to having a driving accident? Do you feel safe driving with them? Do you think they're safe? All of those things are very important. There's another thing called the trail making test. And you don't need me to recommend a specific one. You just need to go on Google and type in trail making test, and it'll give you options A and B. And there are some really good ones out there, and they do they are quite helpful. There are ways to score them, which are often printed right on the forms with them. But it's unsafe if it takes you more than 3 minutes to do test B, and or if you have more than three errors. And what you're doing in this, just if you've never seen one before, you're going from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4, and the numbers are kind of scattered around, and the patient has to draw kind of a trail around to connect them in the appropriate order. They make it a little bit harder in B by putting in the letters as well. So you go from 1 to A, from A to 2, from 2 to B, and so on. And so you have to do a little bit of thinking. And obviously that takes some time. So it's a really good test of kind of functional cognition.
And just listening to you say that, I've got a clue what you're talking about. I don't think I should ever drive again.
I know you shouldn't drive. So, and then there's trail making test A, which is similar, but is easier to do. And if they take more than 48 seconds, so just shy of a minute, they need a driving evaluation. And that's what many of these things point to, is if you're uncertain, send them for a formal driving evaluation. Some other things that can be helpful are the clock drawing test. It predicts performance on a driving simulator. A history of crashes or near crashes. MoCA is less than 18, and drawing intersecting pentagrams. So when you draw a pentagram one over the other where one corner overlaps on each and you ask patients to do it, they often really struggle to draw that when they're cognitively impaired. And this is these are kind of standard tests that are often used. The Canadian Medical Association says that moderate dementia would be a high risk factor and needs driving evaluation. And how they define that is if a person has troubles with two IADLs, so instrumental activities of daily living, like banking on their own, doing their finances, etc. And then the basic ADLs are like showering, taking care of, dressing, all that kind of thing. If they have one of those or two IADLs, then they're likely moderate dementia. But MSE really has no predictive powers. Which is interesting. So it's not something that we should use, and it's interesting because I used to include that early in my practice as part of the assessment for driving safety. So there's all sorts of criteria with the trail making test B. If it's in the 2 to 3 range, it takes patients 2 to 3 minutes to complete. then they should be assessed. And if they have two errors, they need to be assessed. But if they take less than 2 minutes and if they have less than two errors, then they're likely safe for driving as well. So other articles point out that none of these are perfect on their own. And I think we all know that. This is not, there's no perfect way to assess driver's safety in the office for patients suffering with cognitive impairment. But the research does seem to suggest that A and B, trail making tests A and B are helpful, and B is likely the most helpful. The MoCA cutoff and clock drawing, and then the other things like family member concerns or past or near motor vehicle crashes are also helpful. There's no RCTs. I don't imagine we'll ever get one. That would be remarkable to me, or certainly not in my practice lifetime. And none of the tests are singularly reliable. I've told you the trail making test B is good. And again, it's easy to find on Google. I'm going to be using it now, but it is probably the most helpful, but it can't be used on its own. So like we said, several factors are important: family concerns, past or near motor vehicle crashes, the MoCA clock drawing, and the trail making test A and B can help discern things. MSE can't. Nothing's definitive, but if you're suspicious, a comprehensive on-road driving assessment or one of those driving referral programs can be helpful.
Great stuff. Yeah, I mean, because this is as you said, this is a difficult thing, and
it's a terrible thing.
There are consequences to the decision, right? And it's great that there is at least some objective way of looking at it, but this is all very, very tricky.
It is. It's hard because you're sitting there and you know you're taking away from this patient their mobility, their ease of getting around and functioning, and it's going to erode some of that for them and for their spouse, if the spouse is still around.
Yeah.
And if you compare that to, and it could be their friends. This could be one of the few drivers in their friend group, et cetera.
Yeah. No,
and then you're really asking family members to take on more responsibility for that, for the care of that elder. So there's a lot of things, but then on the other side of the coin, if you saw your patient get in a motor vehicle crash and you knew ahead of time that they were at high risk, you would also feel terrible about those consequences, both for them and the people that they've hit. So it's a very tricky thing. There's nothing absolutely perfect. It would be great to have a blood test, but that's a long way off to never. So yeah. Sam, what's our last one though?
I was going to say, you heard it here. Medicine is difficult.
Yeah, it is.
All right. So our last one is about complementary health products again, and this time in the context of the common cold. So this article was chosen by family doctors. It was a review article by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And it talks about four different areas of complementary health products that might be effective to help treat or prevent the common cold. So the first one is probiotics. And so the probiotics have been shown to decrease the occurrence of upper respiratory tract infections, and maybe they may help to shorten illness duration by about 2 days. This has been shown not only in the Cochrane review, but also in several other different systematic reviews that we looked at. And generally speaking, probiotics are thought to be pretty well tolerated. So there may be a role for probiotics. However, what we do see is that the quality of evidence behind this is low quality evidence. There's a lot of inconsistency seen across the trials for probiotics, so a caveat to keep in mind. In terms of zinc lozenges or syrup, for the treatment of a common cold, it may help to shorten the illness by about 1 day, but it does not change the severity of illness. And this has been seen in a Cochrane review and again through a few other systematic reviews. So if you take zinc, so at a dose of greater than 75 milligrams a day, within 24 hours of the onset of a cold, it may help to shorten the duration of illness, but it won't change the severity of a cold. Zinc is associated with some GI side effects, so taste disturbances and nausea. And just keep in mind that we don't recommend the nasal formulation of zinc because it has been associated with a long-lasting loss of smell. So if you are going to recommend it, the oral formulations are preferred. Again, the same issues with zinc in that there's a lot of inconsistencies across the studies for zinc. And so keep that in mind in terms of a caveat.
I remember when I reviewed the evidence for zinc, and I can't quite remember how it goes, but in peds, I think it was, you can treat it, but you can't prevent it. And in adults, you can prevent it, but you can't treat it. It became really quite complicated, and that made me very suspicious. And with the probiotics, Mike Kolber and I noticed that for preventing diarrhea, that there seemed to be great inconsistencies. So we did a meta-analysis where we grouped funded, industry-funded and non-industry-funded research, and we found that the industry-funded research was positive, where the non-industry was not positive. So there was some of what's happening here is industry funding, which people often point at the drug industry, but it's also true of nutraceuticals and natural remedies as well, that funding plays a role.
Mm-hmm. And the other comment just to add is that for probiotics, the benefit is seen for adults, but not consistently with children. So another similarity to the zinc that you saw. For honey, there are some small studies in children suggesting that honey is slightly better for reducing cough than placebo. And we looked at the updated Cochrane review for this. And after 3 days of therapy, honey is associated with a faster onset relief, so about 3/4 of a day compared with placebo. And it has a slight benefit. So if you imagine a 7-point Likert scale, if you ask a caregiver how the child is doing, they'll say that the frequency of cough has been reduced by 1 point. The severity of cough also about 1 point, and the child and parent's sleep has been reduced or improved by 1 point. So it has a modest effect. What we can say from a practical point of view is that probably no more than 3 days is enough, because when they looked at data out to 5 days, all those outcomes were no longer statistically different. And they are associated with some gastrointestinal symptoms with a number needed to harm of 100, but can occur. And again, the data is based on some small number of trials with small sample sizes.
And some people may wonder about dosing and that kind of thing. One of the things we know about dosing is they were kind of all over the map a bit, I think, to 2.5 mils to 10 mils of honey. You can't give it in kids under the age of one, obviously, for risk of botulism. And that these were all done as a single nighttime dose.
Yep, generally speaking, yes. So in all different kinds of honey, so it's hard to figure out like which honey is the right one. They've studied all different kinds from all over the world, so it's difficult to tell.
And Sam, I was just going to ask, so the numbers needed to harm of 100, so that was that statistically different in that study?
Yes, it was.
Because that's
just the 12%.
Yeah, versus 11%.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so it's a small difference.
And the nice thing relatively about honey, one, it's probably not that difficult to get the child to use it, and at least it gives you the feel that you're doing something, you know.
Yes.
We know cough and cold remedies that are available for kids under the age of 6 really should almost, I think, never be used.
I agree.
The evidence is pretty clear. One, they don't work, and this is old data, but they are responsible for, I think, 20 to 25% of all accidental overdoses in kids because they taste delicious.
They also end up, they're associated with adverse events leading to hospitalizations more and all sorts of things. I don't think there's an upside to them at all. The evidence is they don't work in these kids and that age group in particular, and they barely work otherwise. So, I just can't imagine why they're even available anymore. I think there is warnings on bottles now, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Yeah, no. And the reason that they're available is that almost every one of the medications that's in them were around well before there was any need to do studies to show that they worked. Mm-hmm. So that's the problem. It may sound ridiculous that, you know, all you had to do, I thought prior to 1961, I think all you had to do is show that the medication just didn't kill everybody. You didn't have to show it worked.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. So anyway, so we got one more potential treatment.
Yep. So saline nasal rinses, I think, are pretty popular. They may have some symptomatic benefit for the common cold, according to this review article. When you look at the most recent meta-analysis that had five trials, and they were very small trials, most of those trials suggested there was no difference compared to placebo. When you look at the biggest trial that was inside this meta-analysis, it did show some benefit. So a reduction in nasal secretion score and a nasal breathing score. But when you look at that 4-point scale, it was a difference of 0.3. So that's arguably a small improvement and maybe not even really clinically that important. So I think overall it's pretty, I don't think there's a lot of benefit here. And you also have to consider that it's not that comfortable to like put nasal rinses up your nose. And it can be somewhat irritating. If the patient is going to try and do it, they should avoid using tap water just for sterility reasons. So there's pretty limited data around saline nasal rinses.
Yeah, when I've looked at that data, I would say that it doesn't work for acute respiratory illnesses, but it does. There is some benefit in allergic rhinosinusitis and rhinosinusitis that's chronic in nature, but not really for patients with acute symptoms.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And like I said, it's not the most comfortable thing to do, that's for sure.
Yeah, when it has so little effect, there's probably, like when it works in the other populations, it's still uncomfortable, but at least it's working.
Yeah. and you know what's interesting is that and I haven't used this for years, but and I, to be honest with you, I've never gone back and look to see the level of studies. The topical, you know, the topical decongestants, you know, the ones that you put up your nose. Mm-hmm. Here's where this gets tricky, and I'm going to talk about, do you always need an RCT? Because in my experience with using it, and I've talked to other people about it, you know, you with those products, you get almost immediate relief, from, you know, runny nose and all that sort of stuff. And it may be just because you're, you know, putting something into your nose. But in those circumstances where you are getting an immediate relief, you may not need these perfectly designed randomized controlled trials. So the only sort of medication that I've ever recommended for anything to do with a common cold is just topical in the nose type of sprays. And again, that's just from personal experience and also talking to a number of people who say it benefits them. And whenever you can topically apply something, that's probably better than not. So that's a caveat in that I'm actually unaware of really solid RCTs showing that, but this is where you get the blend of, you know, experience, evidence, and so on.
You're talking about the ephedrine type sprays,
yeah, exactly.
The corticosteroid sprays.
No, not the steroid sprays. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. No, the decongestants.
Yeah. Well, and patients get hooked on them. That's one of the problems.
Yeah, now that
chronic rhinosinusitis.
So, yeah, I was going to make a bunch of comments about, one, you should only use it for 2 or 3 days. And, you know, there's also a debate about, you know, what if you've got, I think, glaucoma, what if you got blood pressure? Again, limit it to 2 to 3 days. If it helps you, great. If not, then, you know, we don't have a whole heck of a lot, as you know, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So finally, this report talked about how there's no evidence to support supplemental use any of these, so vitamin C, American ginseng, echinacea, and garlic for the treatment or prevention of the common cold. So it's actually a pretty good little review article just summarizing some pretty good quality evidence that's out there just in terms of looking at the best quality meta-analysis out there.
Excellent. Yeah, well, there's a lot of...
Go ahead, Mike.
The common cold is a bit... We see patients for it all the time, even in the summer, although it's definitely a lot more in the winter.
Which is why I think that's why it's called the common cold.
I know, but interestingly enough, we can go on about this. The research treats it like it's a rare disorder. We don't get a lot of good research for it. And when we do, some of it's terrible. The vitamin D paper and BMJ use odds ratios for a very, very common event and all sorts of things. So it's actually a difficult area to... try and sort out the evidence base. It's generally poor quality, short. And when I mean short, I mean hours. Studies that aren't very high quality. So it is very, very tricky to actually know what to do here. I think most of the effects, unfortunately, are unreliable. I still don't recommend, if people are really pushing, I might suggest they can try zinc, but for the most part, I don't recommend probiotics. I certainly don't recommend ginseng, echinacea, garlic, or vitamin C. Mm-hmm.
I agree.
Okay, so some closing comments. We've looked over 10 articles now, I think, and from the self-learning program, which I think points out these are the top ones chosen by the readers, and I think it points out there's a lot of great content there for primary care providers like family docs. We also though looked to see how often is the message different from what we would say if we scan the literature ourselves. And this is important because self-learning, you'd like it to be a definitive statement, but like any kind of program, like ACP Journal Club, like Info Poems, when it's pulled from up single articles, then it has the potential to, that single article might not represent what's seen in the rest of the evidence base. So we wanted to look at that for self-learning, and the authors of self-learning, being here at the college, I know them, and we've chatted about this, and sometimes they're choosing things to be a bit provocative or to get people thinking. So, you know, I wouldn't expect these to be 100%, and James, you and I do that very same thing at times. Mm-hmm. But we did find that melatonin for headaches probably needed a little bit different look. And the BP over clothing, maybe it agreed with the guidelines, but the past literature, some of it in young people, didn't find as big a difference in blood pressure. But overall, 8 out of 10 needed absolutely no caveats, and the other two needed some kind of, I would say the BP one, a small caveat, and the melatonin one, probably. But I think they were being provocative with the melatonin one.
Yeah, but with the caveat is that everything needs caveats.
Yes, absolutely. This is pretty good, I would say. When you go looking hard to try and find, to make sure that the message is consistent with other research, 8 out of 10 times, most people can't say that for the things we recommend in practice.
No, exactly.
And it certainly can't be said when we review things like Dr. Oz and that kind of thing for sure, not even remotely close. So
yeah, no, that's good.
This is pretty good.
Yeah, so guys, that was great stuff. I know it's a lot of work to put this together, and you guys have provided lots of useful little how do you deal with this one little particular issue. And I think that's a lot of what family practice is all about, as you guys, I'm sure you know very, very well. So hopefully all of this was useful to everyone. And it was nice to have you on board, Sam. You, like I said, you did a great job of putting all this stuff together. Anything you want to sell, Mike?
Nothing right now, James. Thanks.
Yeah. No, but you got your course coming up.
Yes, we have our course in October. We'll be starting more soon.
For sure.
Yeah.
So I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.
Thank you.